For WMRA News, I'm Dan Easley. More than 100 arrests made during peace protests on Virginia college campuses, work to remove forever chemicals from drinking water, and a look at the history of methamphetamine in the United States. This is the WMRA Daily for Wednesday, May 1st. More than 100 people on three college campuses in Virginia have been arrested since Friday. Earlier this week, 13 people were arrested at VCU while protesting U.S. military support for Israel. The Israeli military has killed more than 34,000 people in Gaza since October, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. VPM News' Jad Khalil reports that responses to law enforcement's use of force from politicians have been mixed. A warning that this report has graphic audio.
The students had gathered outside a VCU library since the morning, singing songs and chanting against the war in Gaza. After they erected tents, police came and issued a set of warnings.
This is VCU police. This gathering is in violation of VCU policy, and we are directing you to leave the area immediately.
Then law enforcement moved to break up the protest. Students resisted and threw water bottles. Police used pepper spray. And protesters flushed their faces with water.
Just don't rub it in, okay? Inside to outside, ready? I know, I'm so sorry.
Some state and local Democrats condemned the use of force. They range from mayoral candidate and city councilman Andreas Addison to Senator Saddam Saleem of Fairfax. U.S. Senator Mark Warner didn't directly respond to a question on whether the use of force was appropriate.
My hope is that the college presidents and administrations will be communicating with each other and try to show appropriate restraint. But again, when the law is broken, there needs to be consequences.
Governor Glenn Youngkin and other Republicans condemned the actions of protesters. Jad Khalil, VPM News.
The Environmental Protection Agency now requires water treatment plants to test for contaminants known as forever chemicals. The substances are water, grease, and stain resistant and used in products such as nonstick coatings and waterproofing. Forever chemicals are also hazardous to human health, linked to liver damage, cancer, and birth defects. A lab in the Commonwealth is working on technology to remove forever chemicals from the water, as Virginia Public Radio's Sandy Hossman reports.
This is the sound of a continuous electronic beam accelerator, or CBAF. It's used at a global center for research in Newport News, the Jefferson Lab, employed to perform studies in the field of physics. Buried 25 feet deep, this facility, nearly a mile in length, enables scientists to produce a stream of charged electrons so powerful it can break up molecules. Take forever chemicals, for example. The accelerator can reduce them to their parts, according to scientist John Vanicate.
Breaking it down to the individual building blocks of carbon atoms and fluoride atoms, that's all not harmful, or at least way easier to deal with.
But it would be far too expensive for water treatment plants to build particle accelerators. So the Jefferson Lab hopes to downsize this technology.
We're looking into designing compact accelerators about the size of a shipping container.
And to speed that process along, he says, the lab has received a $7.5 million grant from the U.S. Department of Energy. He hopes a new compact accelerator can be ready to serve public water systems in less than a decade. I'm Sandy Hausman.
The former sheriff of Culpeper County is now scheduled to go to trial in July on 13 federal charges of conspiracy, fraud, and bribery. His three co-defendants have all already pleaded guilty, as WMRA's Randy B. Hagee reports.
As of last week, the third and final co-conspirator has pled guilty in the alleged badges for cash scheme orchestrated by former Culpeper County Sheriff Scott Jenkins and an unnamed auxiliary deputy. Jenkins stands accused of accepting more than $72,000 in bribes in exchange for appointing people as auxiliary deputy sheriffs, which he said would allow them to carry a concealed firearm in any state without a permit. The three co-defendants, all businessmen from Northern Virginia, are now awaiting sentencing on October 7th. Jenkins' trial is scheduled for July 22nd through the 30th in the Charlottesville Federal Courthouse before Senior Judge Norman K. Moon. The continuance order notes that the prosecution stems from a multi-year investigation, and the vast amount of evidence includes many audio and video recordings. Three statements of facts signed by each co-defendant lay out how each bribe was made, ranging from $5,000 to more than $25,000 in exchange for auxiliary deputy appointments in Culpeper County, where none of them lived. Frederick Gumbener and James Metcalf each pled guilty to one count of bribery involving federal programs. Rick Rahim pled guilty to one count of conspiracy to defraud the United States and one count of honest services mail fraud. Rahim has unspecified prior felony convictions which prevented him from owning firearms. According to the statements, Jenkins had arranged a fake lease agreement for Rahim to claim Culpeper County residency and pressured circuit court officials to grant Rahim's petition for the restoration of his firearm rights. The U.S. Department of Justice reported last month that Rahim also pled guilty in a separate federal case for failing to pay more than $1.8 million in taxes to the IRS. For WMRA News, I'm Randy B. Hagee.
Find links to more information at WMRA.org. Student protests and resulting arrests have recently upended life at some universities in the Commonwealth. Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope reports on how political leadership is handling the protests.
Governor Glenn Youngkin says he stands with law enforcement officials who arrested some students at Virginia Tech and Virginia Commonwealth University over the last few days. Former Republican Governor Jim Gilmore agrees with Youngkin's law and order approach.
We're not going to stop people from saying what they want to say or their expression. But we have an absolute right to regulate behavior. So when you set up tents and uglify campuses, when you assault Jewish students, when you fail to cooperate with police, this is behavior.
Delegate Joshua Cole is a Democrat from Prince William County who says he visited the campus of the University of Mary Washington where some student protesters were arrested last weekend. And he says it's important that students continue to have the right to speak their mind and assemble peacefully.
We do not stand and support anti-Semitic statements, behaviors, anything like that. But we do want to make sure that people understand what's happening to the innocent Palestinians is not right. That doesn't mean we stand with Hamas either. That just simply says we're standing with the innocent civilians.
Cole was one of the five young Democratic members of the General Assembly who signed a letter supporting the right of students to protest. House Republican leader Todd Gilbert reacted to that letter by saying the young Democrats are failing to recognize the unlawful nature of some of the protests. I'm Michael Pope.
The history of methamphetamine in the United States is fractured, crossing both northern and southern borders. Its use and distribution, too, developed independently in different parts of the country. A new podcast called Home Cooked explores that history. It's hosted by Olivia Weeks, a reporter with The Daily Yonder, an online publication focused on rural people and places. BPM News editor Dave Cantor recently spoke with Weeks about the podcast.
I believe you said that most meth in Virginia isn't made here. So where does it come from and when did it start to show up?
At this point, most meth in the United States is not made anywhere near where it's used or sold. It's mostly made south of the border in Mexico. Now, in an earlier version of the methamphetamine problem, in the 90s and early 2000s, in some places, a lot of meth was made in local areas by local users. That was really true in the Western US. That was also really true in the Midwest. Now, on the East Coast, that was never really true. So even sort of the era that gave meth its stereotype as, you know, something that's made in the basement or in the barn, that never happened in Virginia. In Virginia, even in like 2002, most meth was coming from Mexico. So Virginia had sort of a different meth problem from the very beginning than the rest of the country or the Midwest in particular.
That podcast, I think, talks a lot about 30 Rock making meth jokes, which I totally forgot about.
The reason for this podcast was that we felt like methamphetamine had this sort of stereotypical cultural rural association. And we're a national rural news source, and so we wanted to understand why that was. And basically, what I found was that in the early 2000s and the 90s, it made sense that there was sort of a rural stereotype around meth because when you were making methamphetamine in these like sort of medium scale mom and pop labs, enough for like a social group of people to get high every day from this meth lab, at that scale, you really needed to sort of be out in the country to make meth because it smelled really bad and because you didn't want your neighbors watching you, that sort of thing. And also, a lot of the chemicals sort of have this rural association. Like, one chemical that you need to make meth in some recipes, anhydrous ammonia, is a farm fertilizer. And so if there's a farm supply store nearby, or if there's a farmer that you can steal from nearby, that's going to sort of make you want to be in the countryside to make methamphetamine. And so there was this, like, rural association that made sense. But then by the time that 30 Rock is making jokes about it, it doesn't really make sense anymore, because it's in 2011, 2010, that kind of thing. It's that shake and bake operation, like we were saying, like people in their cars making methamphetamine, and people are doing that everywhere. And so I think that that rural association really stuck around much longer than it was useful. And it's part of why I think the methamphetamine problem that we're facing today gets sort of weird and undersized attention compared to, say, the opioid epidemic.
So there are health impacts related to meth as well as legal implications, I guess. So have you seen a change in how law enforcement and courts have dealt with the drug during the past 50 years? Because I do think the perception of it has changed as well.
I mean, yeah, law enforcement has handled this drug completely differently at different points. You say in the last 50 years. 50 years ago, well, a little over 50 years ago in 1971 or 1970, methamphetamine was legal and widely accessible. And 10 years before that, it was sold over the counter as a decongestant. It has not always been this sort of scary illicit drug that it's made out to be now. And there are sort of good reasons for that. But then, yeah, so over time, I think in the 90s, police didn't really know what was going on with methamphetamine. They didn't really know how to recognize a meth lab, and then they get better at recognizing meth labs, and then they're finding meth labs everywhere they look. And I think that used to carry really harsh sentences and still does in some places. But I think the meth problem has gotten so much bigger because it's much easier to produce a lot of meth in this sort of pseudo-professional system in Mexico. And so the seizures that you're seeing now are so much bigger than they were when it was some guy making meth in the barn. And at the same time, I think in general, this is sort of very broadly speaking, but in general, I think mass incarceration is less popular than it once was. People don't want to fund prisons in the way that they did 20, 30 years ago. And so sentences have gotten smaller as sort of the meth problem has gotten bigger. Now, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but the legal system is really having to adapt all the time to changes in this drug. And it's also changing this drug. So at every point where the legal system reduces access to a precursor chemical or like stamps out one method of production, a new method of production comes about. And so that's why meth is made in Mexico now, because they made it really hard to make methamphetamine in the US around 2005. And so meth was always made in Mexico, but then now there's not even any reason to really try and make methamphetamine in the US because it's so easy, so cheap to make it in Mexico and then send it over. So yeah, it's like all throughout meth's history, there's this really complicated interplay between law enforcement and the drugs supply chain.
Has anything that law enforcement has done, whether it's restricting access to chemicals, has that actually affected use?
The trend over time is definitely that meth use has increased, and that's not for a lack of law enforcement's trying. If you look at from 1990 to today, the trend line is entirely positive, maybe with some slight ups and downs at different moments. What they have been able to stamp out is, as I've said, domestic production of meth. Now, that comes with its own sort of specific risks. So you don't really want meth labs exploding in your town. If you can reduce that without reducing the use of methamphetamine, maybe you count that as a win and move on. So they have affected some parts of the methamphetamine system. But as I said, the trend line is really only positive.
Is there some strategy that you think you encountered while reporting this that would be useful for law enforcement to implement?
I don't think so. And I don't think that like decriminalization is a straightforward answer. I think it sounds like a pretty painful and difficult one. But I think that's the one that I'm the most interested in, because I think it could really help reduce overdose deaths and potentially at least funnel some resources away from law enforcement, which I think has really served to make this problem worse over time, and into other systems. But I still think that that's a pretty depressing world to live in.
That was reporter Olivia Weeks speaking with VPM News editor Dave Cantor. For WMRA News, I'm Dan Easley. Thanks for listening.